This is Anodized. On this episode, we'll be discussing Apple's app stores. I'm Clinton Phillips, and joining me, as always, except for that one time, is John Chidgey. How you going, John?
Except for that one time, I'm doing fantastic. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm good. Okay, so but before we sort of dive into looking at the Mac App Store and the iOS App Store, do you want to give like a quick overview of how software is being distributed throughout the years?
Yeah, okay, sure. When computers first were sold to the to consumers, the software tended to be sold on physical media that would ship with the computer. And if it didn't, you'd have to go into a computer store and actually buy the software from a box on a bunch of floppy disks. Fast forward, that progressed onto being CDs, physical media. So operating systems, software, whatever else. And as a developer, you would have to go through all the bullshit rigmarole of, you know, getting these things mass produced, which was very expensive and put the price of that software up a fair bit more. Plus you had a much more limited market. People had to, the foot traffic had to come into the store and go in and go on the shelf and have a look at the boxes and buy them. There's also other issues with timeliness, because you had this situation where you would mass produce, you have to, in order for Microsoft to mass produce Windows 95 on as many CDs as they needed to meet demand, they had to start making it months ahead of time, months ahead of the release date. And, you know, that required a lot more planning. And also, because in the early days where there was no internet, everything, all the patches and everything that you got, you had to make really sure when that software went out that it was as solid as you could make it, because it was so hard to get patches distributed to people. So, I mean, there were bulletin boards and so on that you could dial in on dial-up, and the download speeds are terrible. Fortunately, the size of the files are smaller, but irrespective, it was just painful. It was really painful. So then, as the internet came along, people started to do soft downloads. So you could host your own website, put your software up on there, and put a link there. So once any customer you had who may have bought software from you from physical media could then get download their updates. That's how it started. And then people realized that they could then just, you know, cut out the box entirely and ship their own box online. As people started to get, ship their own software from online, as it were. And it was a lot easier because, you know, once people start to trust the whole internet thing of putting their credit card details over the internet, and then I guess there was PayPal, but still most places don't rely on PayPal because of the fees, but irrespective, it was a lot easier. So, but the problem was you still had to go and find these people's website, and you had to get your name out there, and domain names were absolutely critical. So it had to align with what you were doing. So you couldn't just say, this is my awesome software URL.com. It had to be meaningful, and you had to, you know, do a lot more publicity and all that stuff to get people to find your website, do the download to get your software. And then, well, the iPhone happened, and that's when things started to change with the advent of the App Store. And that's what the main topic is of this episode.
Yeah, well, that's a good overview of what happened. The only thing that I'd add there is that computer magazines were a big part of software distribution as well, because they'd distribute... you know, I don't know if they ever did floppy disks, but you get the shareware CD with, you know, umpteen hundred things on it that, you know, and then you could, you know, mail off to buy the full version of the software, or, you know, once the internet was going, you just send off for the license key. And I think patches could be distributed through those as well.
You're absolutely right, and you're quite right, I did miss that, but you're right, yes. They did have floppy disks back in the day. I remember buying at least one that had a 5 1/4 floppy disk on the front, and later on the 3.5-inch disks became more popular, and then as soon as they could get onto CDs, they did. My memory of those was the amount of crap that was on them, because you'd buy the magazine. The magazines are worth so much. They were something like, you know, $15-$20, and none of them were, well, you know, they're backwater like Australia, I guess, in relative terms internationally. You know, we didn't have our own in-house magazines generally. They were almost all the ones that had the CDs and, you know, floppy disks and everything. They came from the UK, one or two from the US, and they were so expensive. They were $15-$20 a pop, and that was, you know, a fair chunk of change. But then again, they had awesome software on there that you just couldn't get any other way. But there was, it was all really small, compressed down. I remember that they used to, the floppies, they used to compress them down, and they'd come with an unarchiving utility on them, like LHA or ARJ, or the early DOS RAR, sorry, WinZip, I should say, or PKZIP, or LHZ. All these different abbreviations. If none of that's ringing a bell, never mind. But the point is that you would extract from any one of the 100 files on these floppy disks, and it'd expand into a much bigger size, and you'd then run the software and say, oh, cool, I got a bargain. But yes, God, things have changed, thank God.
Yeah, it's changed a lot. So, and I think things have changed for the better, because if you look at what benefits having an app store brings, it makes third-party software more visible to consumers, and it's a lot easier to find things, because you to get the third-party software, like from a magazine, well, you'd only ever get what's on the disc. And but when you're looking further on the internet, or it's, you had to rely on sites like Version Tracker, or back when Apple had the list of OS X downloads that you can get software through that, you had to be, you know, constantly checking up on these things. If you subscribe to them via email, or if you had subscribed to the RSS feeds, you could see what new software was coming through. And it was always fun to dig through that and to see what new things are. And you discover a lot of software that way. But once the App Store came along, it just makes it easier, because now there's just one place to go through to. So, you know, people like us, we're happy to sort of scour the internet for cool software. But some users just don't know that there are third-party options out there. So it's great that we can, you know, there is a way to get great software into their hands or onto their computer, so that they can use it and get the most out of the devices or the computers that they have.
Absolutely. And I guess what the one thing that I, the step that a lot of people, I think, you know, listening to this will know what the App Store is, but we should probably just quickly cover what Apple did. And we know, we understanding going into this, that they were not the first people to do this, but what they were the first people to bring it to a mass audience. And the concept of the App Store was simple, and that is that when you installed the operating system on your device, in this case it started out with the iPhone, then you would have an application on there, front and center, that you could access, and it would give you a list of software that you could install. Such a simple thing, nothing too flash. You would tap on it, and then you could select and buy it all through your iTunes account. So it was built on the iTunes infrastructure. But the way the software was distributed is Apple put the software on their servers. They provided all the backup for it, and they provided the hosting and everything. All you had to do was go into the App Store, buy it, and it would download and install it for you. You didn't have to do anything else. Just go tap buy, are you sure, type in a password, you're done, and that was it. What then happened is a year or so later, they brought the Mac App Store to the desktop, and I think it came in on 10.6.8.
Yeah.
So that came in then for the Mac. So, and from that point forward, all the Mac desktops had an app store. And of course, the two app stores are completely incompatible. The software written for one is only going to work on that one. So you can't buy software across the two devices, which, you know, sometimes would be convenient, I think, for power users. But
yeah, it would be handy to make a purchase on, like, say you find out about some great utility while you're reading about it on your iPad while you're out, and you go, oh, that's great, I'd love to, you know, buy that and just have it on my Mac when I come home. You can't do that. So, you know, it's rare, but it's just one of those, it would be nice to be able to do that.
Absolutely. I think that it's one of those things that without too much trouble, Apple could probably do that. But, you know, I was talking to some people on Twitter a week or two ago about this, actually, and I think the problem is it could create confusion for customers, and they'll say, oh, well, you know, this is for sale. I want that app. And they don't realize it's a desktop app when they're on their iPad, and then they download it and they pay money for it, and it doesn't work on their iPad, and Apple gets a support phone call. But, you know, I think that could be a stumbling block. But there'd be ways of making it clearer. How Apple would do it, I don't know. But that scenario you described is exactly what I would like to be able to do, because often you'll get, like, snap sales. So for on sale for the next hour is this app for half price or $1 or something. It's normally $10. Yeah, and you're out and about and you're like, well, I don't have my laptop with me. I can't do anything about it. And the moment passes you by. I guess if you're really tech savvy, you have a spare Mac at home with LogMe and Ignition or some kind of remote desktop setup, and you just dial into that and buy it from your iPhone or your iPod, I guess, iPad, but that's super geeky. So yeah, obviously, the great part of the App Store is it's one place for everything. And one of the things I think as a developer is that the advertising, you don't have to advertise as much because Apple will showcase it for you, and you don't have to put it up on a pedestal because Apple will do that for you, but only up to a point, and that's where the wheels start to fall off, I think. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, because Apple will feature apps on the front page of the App Store, and there's a number of different sections. I'll just call it up now.
Yeah, the thing is that I think when the App Store started, it wasn't a problem because you only had a few thousand apps in there. Even that sounds like a lot, but it's not really, especially when you break it down into categories.
Yeah. Well, the problem back in the day, do you remember the very first version of the App Store? There was a section where apps were ordered alphabetically.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, and then you had that phone book effect where everyone wanted to be called Acme.
Yeah.
So if we look at the App Store, I mean, there's a number of... You go to the front page and they have the sort of scrolling thing where, if you're a really good app, you get featured up there. And then there's, editor's choices, best new games, enhanced for device X. And they sort of have all these themes. And, if you're on the front page of that, of the App Store, you will get sales because you're visible. People can see you. And then there's the featured, the top charts. So there's the top paid, the top free, and the top grossing, which has always been a strange category to me because it's saying, look at us, we've made the most money. But if you get into those top lists, you will stay in those top lists because you're visible and people will continue to see you. So you do need to spend some time, effort, and energy, money advertising your software, promoting yourself, because Apple will only promote a very thin sliver of what's on the App Store, because how many hundreds of thousands of apps are on there, and they're not going to promote every single one of them. It's not like a participation award where everyone gets a day on the front page of the App Store.
You should say that, because effectively they do. They get the newer noteworthy, because when you start out, you're on the new page. If you get enough downloads to keep you there, then that could be self-sustaining, but most apps generally don't.
Yeah.
Which is exactly why you say that they need more advertising. You're absolutely right. They do. If they don't, they won't be on the front page long enough. There'll be a big surge for a day or two, and then they'll slide off the page because there's so many apps burying it that are just coming in straight behind it. They're approving so many apps all the time. So, based on what I've read about App Store economics and my own experiences as well with Bedside Clock that I did years ago, it's very much a massive surge at the beginning, and after that it just peters off into nothing, or to background noise levels, should I say. So, and that's, I think, just symptomatic of the fact that there's so many other apps there that are vying for attention. There's only so much space on the front page,
Yeah, that's it. And in the early days of the App Store, it was, it's a lot of people just jumped on it because holy shit, there's gold in their hails. So, you know, there was this massive rush to get onto the App Store to sell your app and to, you know, make $1 million. And there have been developers that have, you know, they've been seriously successful and have made a few $1 million out of their app. And then that's because you're sort of competing with everyone on kind of a level playing field. I mean, all the really expensive apps are like right next to all the cheaper apps. So that sort of rush for everyone to get onto the App Store created this effect where it was an immediate effect. It took a while for that to happen, but how do you compete when you have an app and a competitor has an app? It might not be as good, but you know, you have similar sort of features. Well, the only place that you can compete is on price. So people started lowering and lowering the prices. So that's where you had that, they called it the race to the bottom, where it was, okay, well, let's see how low we can drive the prices down and, you know, and make sales. And a lot of people were able to make it up in volume, but it's not a successful model for everyone. Not everyone can sell a 99-cent app and, you know, make their money back on development.
Yeah, exactly. And that race to the bottom problem, it's interesting because it sort of cuts both ways. If you've got an app, let's say that not every app is perfect and that there is a finite number of bugs in that app that will manifest itself. Therefore, assuming an even distribution, if you have 100,000 downloads and you make, forget the 30% thing, but, you know, so what? No, fine, 30%. So you make 70 grand for your $1 app. You may have 5% of that, let's say, as support emails. So 5,000 emails every, let's say week. So now you take the same app and you double the price. So it's now $2. You're probably not going to get anywhere near 100,000 downloads. You might get, I don't know, 25,000 downloads or something like that. So let's say you get 25,000 downloads. Well, you're making double the amount of money for that number of downloads. So instead of making 70 grand, you'll make like 35 grand roughly. So you're making 35 grand. So you made less money. But then again, you're not going to get 5,000 support emails each week now. You're only going to get a quarter of that because only a quarter of them sold. Again, assuming everything's even distributed. So how much money is it costing you in support? Well, suddenly you don't have to pay so much in support anymore. So it's kind of funny, you know, you race to the bottom if you've got problems with your software. And let's face it, every piece of software has a problem of some kind, even if it's an obvious silly little thing like, oh, I'm tapping this and nothing's happening. And there's nothing wrong with anything. It's just that their finger's tapping the wrong place. You still got to support that. You'll always have support emails. You'll always have support costs. So the race to the bottom can kill you very quickly, I think. It's a dangerous thing.
Yeah, and there's also apps that, you know, that if they have a online component where the developer needs to maintain a server or something like that, you know, there's a lot of apps will have ongoing costs. So there's sort of this struggle to how do you price things to, one, get people to buy it in the first place, and two, to be able to support your users as they use the software.
Yeah, absolutely right. That's a really good point. And honestly, people don't like paying subscriptions, generally speaking, especially for software. I mean, yeah, it's weird, you know, because there was a time when people would happily pay. And there are still plenty of people out there, I guess, like this, that are happy to pay, I don't know, what, $8 a week for a newspaper every day delivered to their door or whatever it is. I don't know. I haven't had the newspaper delivered in years, but, you know, I used to. And then there's the Reader's Digest, another example. Yeah, or perhaps Women's Weekly or New Idea or Clio, I don't know. Pick a magazine. And you get a new magazine show up on your doorstep. But the difference with software is, you know, the software has a server component. The software you've got itself, the software doesn't change. I mean, can you imagine if Pocket Cast charged a subscription because they've got servers syncing up all their all of their data. So all the podcasts might change, but you've paid once for the software. Now they want an ongoing cost for the server.
Yeah.
It's like, how do you sell that? It's not a new, it's not a different piece of physical paper with different print on it. It's something virtual.
Mm.
And I think it's people, they're struggling to move away from the fixed price to a subscription system. I mean, Microsoft are trying.
Yeah.
And so is Adobe with their creative stuff, Creative Suite. But I don't think they're having that much luck, statistically.
No, I don't know the numbers, so I can't speak to that.
No, I'm afraid I can't either. But no.
Doing something that I read recently is you can't actually do subscriptions through an app.
I don't think so.
Possible. So, you know, technically they can't do that anyway. But I think, even if they did, I'm not sure that that would fly. Not sure how well consumers would, how well they would take to that.
Yeah, I don't know. All I know is that the practicalities of subscription software aren't supported in either of the app stores. You can't subscribe to an app, and you can't subscribe to that on desktop or on iOS. It's not supported. You buy it outright, or it's free. You know, that's it. Yeah. Those are your choices.
Or there's the in-app purchases.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, okay, fine. Quite right. So you can go free and have in-app purchases, or you could pay money and still have in-app purchases.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know, I find a bit odd. I'm really not a fan of in-app purchases. I think that they're quite, They compensate for other problems, I think, on the App Store.
Yeah.
And that's probably the next thing we should talk about. So let's talk about some of the negatives.
Let's get back into that shortly, but I just want to talk just a little bit about in-app purchases now.
All right.
What do you tend to find that in-app purchases are used for? Because my experience with in-app purchases has been mostly through games, but where have you seen them?
Well, to be honest, my answer is the same as yours.
Yeah.
I've come across a handful of apps where you would unlock key functionality that you might want. I'm trying to think of the examples now, but Letterpress was a beautifully done one because it was so obviously not a big deal, but you were obviously helping the developer through the in-app purchase. And yeah, well, everyone loves Lauren Brichter, so you know, sure, no problem.
Yeah,
happy to help you to do that. It was a great app and a great game, and I still love it.
Yeah, and Twitterific was another one that they had an in-app purchase.
Yeah, I haven't used Twitterific in years. I bought it a couple of years ago, and the syncing never worked quite right, and I switched to Tweetbot and never really looked back. But what was their in-app purchase for?
I can't even remember. I bought it so long ago, I'm not sure if they still offer it in the new version.
All right, fair enough. Well, look, my most experience with in-app purchase is bullshit for games.
Yeah. And that's exactly right, bullshit for games.
Yeah, because it's like, you can finish the game without buying anything, but it's really hard and it's going to take you a really long time.
Yeah.
But, you can buy these super Real Racing missiles. 3,
that was one that I've heard a lot of complaints about that, you know, the amount of hours that you would have to put into to be able to do things that were, you know, you can just give EA some more money and, get, it's pay to win. So that's a complaint that I hear a lot, that the amount of money that you have to sink into a game just to be able to play it, it can get a bit ridiculous. So there's sort of this fine line between doing it well and just doing it so fucking wrong.
Well, the thing that I have an issue with is, go back to the days of arcade machines, where arcade machines were the only way to really get games, like advanced games. So I just keep thinking of one example, Space Harrier, for example. You'd go along and you'd be fighting along and you would die. You would then get a countdown for 10 seconds. Do you want to continue? Pop in some more money. And the concept was obvious, if you were good enough and you were like, you had your skill was such that you could get to the end without dying, without needing a continue, then it would only cost you 40 cents or whatever it was to play the game. But if you were not so skilled, you were going to have to pay more money to get to the end. And if you didn't continue, you went back to the beginning and started over. So it was like, it was a system where essentially you had to pay money if your skill level was not high enough for you to be able to finish. In the app store, in-app purchases, that's not the way it works. Generally, that I've seen, it's a matter of, not a matter of if your skill, if you have enough skill, it's simply a matter of if you have, you want to get to the end goal for a level, and you need to buy a couple of extra things like coins or jewels or turns, you know, like with Candy Crush or with Skylanders, like Space Patrol or whatever, what's another one? Subway Surfers. You know, you got to go in and buy all these extra things, and that'll give you not extra time because of skill. It'll give you extra stuff to make it easier to finish. So if you want an extra few turns in Candy Crush, you can buy them. You know, if you want a faster hoverboard, you can buy it in. If you want to put money into it, you can buy it in Subway Surfers. And it's not so much about skill, it's about a lack of patience almost.
Yeah.
For a lot of these games. It's like you get into the game, you get so into it, and you want to finish this level, and oh crap, I've spent all this time, I want to finish this level and say it's done. Let's just put some money off this thing and buy and get an in-app purchase and away I go. And yay, I finished it. Lovely. And the part of me that really sort of shits me about all this is that I know people that put a lot of money into this stuff.
Oh, yes.
And it's sickening, actually, because I think to myself, you're almost better off going to play the pokies. Because if you did, you might occasionally get some money back. Yeah, I'm not a big fan of gambling pretty much in any form, but I find that this is almost like a form of gambling now. You're paying money for flashy lights and sound effects. And if you listen closely to something, especially like Candy Crush, a lot of the sound effects and a lot of the flashy lights and animations are very, very similar to a modern-day slot machine, poker machine.
Yeah.
Very similar. See, because in a modern poker machine, it's just, you know, you put the money in and then you just push the button depending upon how much you want to bid, right?
Yeah.
And whereas these things, it's really not that different. You're trying to crush a bunch of candy and there's a certain configuration and you want to buy extra credits to continue because you want to keep going. You put some money in and then you can keep going. No different to if you run out of credit on your run out of money in the poker machine. Just put another $5 in. And you can keep going. You might win this time. To me, it just seems like it's, I don't know.
Yeah,
bothers me.
As you were talking about that, I was thinking, hang on, this sounds a lot like a pokey.
Well, it does. People don't stop and think. There's a science to this stuff, you know? And, I mean, people like the flashing lights and the sound effects and the happy noises and stuff like that, and they don't want to hear the bad noises. And, you know, pokies are all about that. And so a lot of these games are now just the same. You don't have to spend money. I guess this is the difference, right? The difference is, in a poker machine, you've got to front up with money every time, or you've got nothing. Whereas with these games, you don't have to. So it's not as extreme as gambling with a poker machine with your money. But the counter argument to that is, once you've spent the money on the game and you've achieved the goal, you come away with nothing guaranteed. You got the satisfaction of finishing that, but you haven't actually, you had never had a chance of getting any money back. And I guess in that sense, is it really gambling? It's more like throwing your money in a hole and covering it over with dirt.
Well, what's the freaking difference between that and gambling?
Well, you might win money with gambling.
Yeah, you might.
I guess the other difference that I can think of is, and it's one of the things that I've sort of grappled with in my life, is how you think about the difference between gambling and gaming.
Yeah.
And reading a book or just whatever you do recreationally for entertainment, like watching TV, you know, pick an activity. You know, is it fun to do this? Is it fun to... Do you have fun sitting there pushing buttons on a poker machine? Well, I don't know. I guess someone does. Doesn't do anything for me. Maybe it does something for other people, but not me. But that's great. Go ahead and do that. You know, I don't like playing games like Candy Crush or any of those other ones. You know, like the Bubble Safari or whatever Zynga's doing these days.
Yeah.
And, you know, I find them to be tedious, but I like sitting down and watching TV. So let's say I pay $5 to watch an episode of I don't know, whatever, Big Bang Theory, Star Trek, whatever. I don't know, it doesn't matter. If I just spend $5 watching an episode of something I download from iTunes, you know, if I spent the same $5 and spent, let's say the episode goes 45 minutes, and that $5 I spent 45 minutes in front of a poker machine and I lose it all, what's the difference? I've spent $5. I've had 45 minutes of entertainment. Who cares, right?
Yeah.
Same with Candy Crush. So it's all, I don't know. I still find the idea of in-app purchases to be a bit scummy.
Yeah, it's a bit insidious.
It's like a bait and switch.
Yeah.
It's like you think you're getting this, but you want a bit more, that's going to cost you. You know, like you get them in the door, you bait them in, and then at the last minute, oh, you can't get to the end. Now I'm going to switch you out and you're all pissed off now.
Yeah.
So I find it to be very disingenuous and a bit scummy. So I would never release an app that had in-app purchases. I just wouldn't do it. I believe that there has to be inherent value in your software up front. But yeah. Then again, I'm not trying to make a living out of doing it. And maybe that's where people compromise their values if they have values. But I don't think I'll ever be in that position, so maybe it doesn't matter what I think. But still. Anyway, geez, that was a bit of a rant, wasn't it, about in-app purchases?
Yeah, it was. So what the fuck were we getting back to?
We were going to start talking about some of the downsides of the
was it trials and demos? Is that what we're on to next?
Yeah, I think let's talk about trials and demos.
Yeah, so that's related to in-app purchases. So the reason why these sort of in-app purchases exist is that Apple doesn't allow trials or demos on either of its app stores.
Well, I would say that's one of the reasons in-app purchases exist.
Yeah.
Yeah, not the only reason. But yeah, I mean, no trials, no demos. That sucks.
It does. A lot of other vendors out there, they support trials or demos. I mean, if you go onto the Xbox Live Arcade, you can get trials and demos of games. Same as Steam, you can get a demo of the game. The Windows App Store, you can get a trial for 7 days. Google Play, apparently they do some trial thingy. I tried to look into that today, but it wasn't too clear on what sort of trial they're offering. But anyway, so there's, you know, Apple's competition is offering free trials. Now, I don't particularly care how successful or how good offering trials are, you know, what the conversion rate is between people downloading the trial and buying the software. The fact is, it's just nicer to be able to try the software, actually use it, to see if it meets your needs, to see if it's suitable, to see if it works the way that you think it works. Because you can't tell that from a fucking screenshot. A screenshot is static. Apps are interactive. So to be able to download a free trial, you know, let's say that Apple offered a time-limited trial, you know, you get 14 days or something like that, and once that's up, every time you launch that app, you're presented with a box saying, buy this app. That would solve so many problems, because imagine all the people that buy things from the App Store, they find out that it doesn't do what they want, and then they got to go through the refund things. It's fucking hard to get a refund from Apple on the on their App Stores. And then there's all the developers that are getting one-star reviews. That they don't deserve those one-star reviews. It's just the user didn't, you know, the app didn't meet their needs. But no, they're going to jump on the fucking App Store and say, oh, this fucking app, this, you know, doesn't do what I want, one fucking star. So, you know, having a trial, I just don't, why the fuck doesn't Apple do it? I don't understand it.
I think, I don't have any insight as to why they don't do it. I just want to put forward, though, my issue with its absence.
Yeah.
Because I've listened to this over and over again on the internet, people going on about, you know, whether it's a good or a bad thing, and if there's some kind of genius in what Apple's doing. I want to break this down into two bits. The first bit I want to talk about is we have an existing model that worked, which was software trials were a commonplace thing. 30-day limit expires and you have to buy a license to keep using the software. And honestly, it worked. It gave people the best of both. They could try it, and then if they liked it, they could buy it if they wanted to keep using it. Of course, there's other ways you can get around it. You know, painful ways usually, like wiping the computer and reinstalling and then reinstalling the software to get another trial. But that's a bit extreme, and most people don't do that. Other ways, less legitimate ways of hacking the software. But frankly, if you're going to be hacking the software, you're not going to pay for it at all, are you?
No, you're not.
That's not really valid. So we had a system that was fine, that worked okay, and then Apple basically took that option away. And they said, oh, we Apple, we know what we're talking about, you know, stiff.
Yeah.
Which I think is ridiculous. It's kind of like coming in and saying, well, you know, we're just not going to let you do this business model anymore just because we don't think it's a good idea or we don't feel like doing it. So the second way of thinking about this is with respect to trials, would you consider it a fair thing to expect a trial at the first place? So I go back to the internet has muddied the waters here. And I know it's because we're talking about software and everyone thinks, oh yeah, software was always around when there was an internet. But you know, it wasn't. Software was around well before the internet. And you know, you gotta think to yourself, well, before there were internet shops that would show you a photo of something like eBay and say, here you go, here's a photo of something. Let's say it's an Xbox One. And someone buys it.
Never mind. Yeah, I read about that today.
Never mind that. Anyhow, poor guy. Never mind that. What you end up is a situation where people become more accustomed to buying things, as they say, sight unseen. But if you just pause that thought and go back to, and just look around any shopping center, what do you see? You'll see a shop with 100 televisions on display on the wall. Like walking to JB Hi-Fi or Harvey Norman or wherever. That's what display models are for.
Yeah.
They are the trial, you know?
And it goes the good stores will have them. If you go to a car dealer, you can test drive the car. If you go to
absolutely.
A bottle shop, they will have, you know, wine on tasting. They usually have good ones, will have tasting bottles open. So it is possible to try a lot of things in the real world before you buy.
That's right. And so then the argument is, okay, is software valuable enough? Now, is it valuable enough? Well, the problem is the App Store caters for all price ranges, although admittedly most of them are free or 99 cents. But yeah, you know, if your app is worth 99 cents, do you really need a trial? You know, well, I don't know.
I'd like a trial.
I know, but you could probably live without it, right?
Yeah.
Well, 99 cents.
Quite some time ago, I got into an argument on app.net. Lex Freeman had posted a piece, and he's saying, use that old, you know, only as much as a cup of coffee argument. And he's saying, yeah. Oh, come on, guys, can't you just like pay for software and try for things and it will be all good? And I said, well, any price is too much when you can't try before you buy. Because what happens is the more times that you buy a 99 cent app and have a bad experience, the less likely you are to do that in future. So I'd still like to have, even for 99 cent apps, I'd like to have a trial. Yeah. You know, maybe you'd only get a day out of them before you had to buy it. But, you know, you just want some, that extra layer of security that, you know, you want as a consumer. You always want, because nobody likes handing over money for something that they're unsure of. So you just want that extra little bit of reassurance that, yes, this is what I want. This is what it's going to do, what I need it to do.
Yeah, okay. I can sort of see where you're coming from there. But I guess where I was going with that is, I was actually going to quote the whole cup of coffee argument, which, you know, is kind of funny considering I don't drink coffee. But, you know, let's assume that in my case it's a bottle of Diet Coke, so $3 or something or whatever the hell it is, depending on where you're buying it.
Get a chocolate bar, cherry ripe.
I hate cherries. Anyway, but moving on. Never mind that. See, that's a little known fact about me. See, dear listeners, I don't like cherries. Mm. So if you ever do want to send me cherries, don't. Actually, no, you can if you really want to, because my kids love them. So does my wife. Anyway, never mind that. I'm getting off topic yet again. Point is, let's say you got $3 for discretionary spending on whatever you may choose to do with your hard-earned $3. Well, whether it's hard-earned or not, I can't comment. They're $3. Anyway, you got it in your pocket. You can think about spending it. You could probably say, oh, yeah, fine, I'll give this app a go for $3. No problem. Of course, then you buy the app, it's crap, and you really wish you had a cup of coffee. But never mind. But you can't buy a cup of coffee anymore because you just spent your money on that app. Anyway, so what happens when you get to $10 and $20? And if you want an OmniFocus, that's like $200.
I know, it's ridiculous.
And the same rule applies across the board. Now, that is insane to me, because there is a system in place right now where it is not possible to do a trial of software on the App Store at all, when the previous generation of selling, the previous generation methodology of selling software, downloading from websites, fully supported trials as flexibly as the software, you know, manufacturer wanted to. And then on top of that, we've now got an app store where you've got prices for software in there that are such that it's quite justifiable to expect, if I'm going to spend $200 on an app, like if I was spending $200 on a TV, I'd like to see one first. You know, I'd like to take it for a test drive. You know, not literally, but
in with all the screenshots.
Well, you know, I honestly think that with software, everything's becoming desensitized. We're becoming accustomed to buying things sight unseen. Like, here's a picture, and you look at the fine print at the bottom, may not resemble final product, and that kind of crap. But we're getting used to it, right?
Yeah.
You know? And people will start saying, oh, yeah, no, that should be right. The screenshots look okay.
Yeah.
And how many times have you bought an app, the screenshots look fantastic, and you buy the app, and it's shit? It's happened to me several times.
Yeah, I've had a few where, like, it looks very pretty, but to actually use it, like, the navigation of the app is just balked. It is just terrible.
I honestly think that with everything that Apple has, there's no reason why they cannot technologically support trials.
There's
no reason at all.
Nothing stopping them whatsoever.
And honestly, what I think they're doing is, I think they're going to do it at some point. I think that they are going to open it up and say, you know what, guys? Now on the App Store, you can have demos and trials.
I should fucking hope so.
Well, it's the sort of thing that Apple does. Yeah, it's cut, copy, and paste, right? Mm. You don't need cut, copy, and paste, you know? Yeah, two versions of iOS later, we've got cut, copy, and paste, guys! It's amazing! And we're like, it's not amazing. Like, every other smartphone's had this for a long time.
Well, what was amazing about it was everyone wanted copy and paste, but Apple went the extra mile and they gave us cut as well.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah, yeah. You remember that? Everyone was saying, where's copy and paste? Where's copy and paste? And they come out and it's like, we have cut copy and paste. Aren't we clever?
But the way they did it is so revolutionary. Look, I'm sorry. I don't want to... But all I know is that Apple, I do like the way that Apple has done their cut, copy, and paste. But frankly, I've done it on Android. I've done it on Android. And I'm trying to think of any others I've done. Not for a long time. I've done it on a Palm, okay? And it was nasty, but that was because it was resistive touch. It wasn't multi-touch, and it just, you know, by comparison to the iPhone, it was absolutely horrible, painful agony. Anyone have done that?
Yeah.
Bad memories come flooding back. Anyhow, the point is that the actual ability to do cut, copy, and paste is not new. They delayed it for 2 years because they had other priorities. I get that. And then they release it, and there's a big hubbub about it. And that's just typical Apple, right? It's like, let's play up something basic that other people have got and say it's like it's some revolutionary thing when it just isn't. You know what I mean? It's like, yep. The iPhone was revolutionary for a whole bunch of reasons. I'm getting sidetracked again. But in the App Store, I think, honestly, bringing that concept to the masses, that was revolutionary. But, you know, copy and paste, no. And when they open up the App Store to trials and demos, that's not going to be revolutionary either. It's just going to be, oh, finally. And like it was with cut, copy, and paste, like, oh, I don't care how much spin you put on it, guys. It'll be like, oh, finally.
Yeah, I'd like to hope that, you know, we do eventually get trials and demos, because I think we seriously need it. But it's not like there's this massive clamoring for trials and demos. You know, there's not this like big movement on the internet. Oh, fucking Apple, where are our trials and our demos? You know, they seem to be getting along just fine without it. And, you know, I strongly suspect that that's going to be their thinking. You know, someone at Apple would say, hey, do you think maybe we should have trials and demos on there? And, you know, they look and go, we don't need it. You know, we're doing just fine. I mean, look at how much money we've paid out to developers. Here's our big novelty check that we hold up at WWDC.
See, the thing is, just because you support trials and demos doesn't mean that the developers have to offer them. And the other thing is that there's always that the argument for, I need to convert my PDF to an Excel spreadsheet now, and I've got one, it needs to be done by the end of the day. But that's the first time I've needed to do that in 2 years.
Yeah.
So what's the point of having a fully featured, fully functional trial if you try and if you solve their problem for 1 day and then they never buy your software? You know, so there is that argument, and then you start crippling your trial version, so they put watermarks on top of things or whatever, or noise or whatever the hell. You know, but that's the app developer's problem. You know, it's not Apple's problem to police that. Yeah. It's the developer's
problem.
Apple
just has to provide the infrastructure to allow
it. That's it. Exactly. And there's nothing at all in it that's complicated.
No. I mean, they've got our account details. They know when it was purchased, and they can have it just hard-coded into the operating system that says this is a trial app. After this amount of time, you know, it gets locked. Every time you open it, you know, you have to. There's a prompt that says, "Well, do you want to buy this app or what?"
Yeah, I honestly think they're going to do it, Clinton. It's just a matter of when. And you know, can you picture an app store in 10 years' time without trials and demos in it? Seriously? I mean, what happens if Android's App Store starts to take off? I realize, you know, it hasn't really taken off to the same extent, but what if they get their shit together in the next few years? What if Google, who's pushing more and more for centralizing and controlling the experience more, what if they become more involved and have like a premium store or something? Or, you know, what happens then if they actually start to make inroads and they start to get on better with developers? I mean, they're on this learning curve, yeah, behind Apple in that respect as a software platform company. But you know what? They're catching up. Is it only a matter of time before Apple start to feel pressure from alternative platforms and they'll have to do it because the other platforms are succeeding and it's one of the reasons they're succeeding? So I think it's inevitable. I think it's only a matter of time. How long it takes, I could not hazard a guess. But, you know, I reckon if no one complained about copy and paste being missing, it would have slipped with another iOS version. Apple are, to some respect, reactive. They listen. They listen to what their customers say, generally, and they try and do something about it and prioritize, you know, relatively well. You know, when there's 1,000 things to do, they do a reasonable job, I think. Reasonably, you know, as can be expected for a company that size. But anyway, all right. So that's that. I think we've done that one to death, haven't we? So
yeah.
This system requirements thing,
yes,
really does shit me.
Yeah.
Because I got caught out by this a while ago. Maybe you can talk a bit more about this one.
Okay. So are we talking more the Mac App Store in this instance?
Either, actually. Okay. But
because when I wrote that note down, that's more what I was thinking about. Because if you go to the Mac App Store, look up any AAA game, and then go into the right-hand column where it says system requirements, the only requirement that you will see is the operating system requirements. So,
yep, no graphics card.
Yeah, nothing about graphics card at all. That's all buried in the main text, you know, that description thing, which is truncated, and all of that is at the bottom, properly buried. Nobody can find it. So if you don't know any better, and you're looking through the thing, and you see this awesome game that everyone's been telling you about, you go, oh, cool, Bioshock Infinite, that's on the Mac, I'll buy that. And you check the system requirements, it says, oh, you need 10 point whatever, and you say, yes, I have 10 point whatever, and you buy it, you download it, you play it, and fuck, it doesn't work because you don't have the right graphics card. You know, so that's a layout problem that Apple needs to... They need to do something about it, and it's been a problem since the Mac App Store's inception, that they just don't have that information up front. It's completely buried. And actually, I'd like them to go a step further, rather than just list, here are the requirements. Why don't, because they make the fucking software, they make the fucking hardware, why don't they have a button on there that says, will this run on my device? Will this run on my computer? And you tap the button, it does some little system check, and it says, yes, this will run, or no, this won't. Sorry, you can't buy it. You know, wouldn't that be fucking fantastic?
Yeah, I just reckon they should have it make it clear that, you know, this application may not perform on your system.
Yeah.
Yeah, click here for more information. Just some kind of warning would be nice. Mm. Anything.
So where did you get stung with it?
I'm trying to think back now, because I know that I got stung by this years ago. It was an app that relied on, it was not the camera, or was it the GPS or some functionality that was not available, even though the iPod Touch could actually, I put myself on the spot. I said it did happen to me, because I'm just trying to remember when it was, because it was years ago.
Yeah.
It was an app that worked fine on my 3GS, but wouldn't work on the kid's iPod Touch because it was missing something.
Yeah.
And there was no anything on the app that said this anywhere. Not in the text. You could buy it on either device, and it did not perform correctly on the other device. And it wasn't a bug. It was simply, if you dug through the release notes, you found a real thing at the bottom, this feature not available on iPod Touch second generation.
Yeah.
And this is all ancient history now, but, you know, there was a divergence problem early on where when I was doing programming for Bedside Clock for the iPhone and iPod Touch version that I never actually ended up releasing. When I was developing that, and Gary MacArthur was helping me out, the original iPod Touch didn't support an audible, all it had was the little notification beep.
Oh, wow.
The little beep, 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 beep thing, alert thing.
Yeah.
So I had custom sounds for the alarm, and you could set custom sounds, but I had to do a special one for the iPod Touch, first generation, where it simply sounded the beeper. And he was the only one that had that hardware. So I was back and forth with Gary quite a bit on that. And he said, oh, you know, it's, yeah, it's working. No, it's not, blah, blah, blah. But there was nowhere when you submitted it to the App Store where you could identify that. You couldn't say, oh, on iPod Touch, first generation, may not have all features.
Yeah.
I was intending to put that in the text, the body text, but that was around about the time when there was a couple of things at work that just hit all at once, if you recall, and I just ran out of time and I never finished.
Yeah.
I just decided to put on the shelf, and that's where it stayed. So I got the iPad version out, but I never got the iPod Touch or iPhone version out, because I'm going to release them separately, if you recall.
Yeah, I do recall. So let's talk a little bit about the descriptions that... developers can use for their apps.
Sure.
The description text, it's sort of this, it's this place where developers put, they just pack it full of information. And there's a call up any app on any app store and just look at the text, and, you know, how long do you have to scroll for? You have to scroll for a fucking long time. because
yeah, you do. Yeah,
there is so much text placed in there because it's sort of because they don't have anywhere to really put anything else. They're stuck with just throwing everything into that one bin. So you will see, and in release notes, you know, there's doing, oh, thank you so much for our customers and making us number one and five stars and bullshit. And yeah, then, you know, a little bit down, you might find, here's what we changed in the app. And then when you look at the description, well, they might have that information in there as well, you know. So it's, they'll have all this bullshit up the top with, you know, fucking stars next to it or whatever. So it's, oh, we're, you know, this place reviewed us and said that we're fucking great. And, you know, they're using that as a space to self-promote rather than just telling you, this is what the app, this is what it does. Because they just don't have anywhere to put that.
No. No, it's a good point. It's sort of the... You really only have one place to put anything, so that's where they put everything.
Yeah.
And that makes it... The customer then has to wade through all that crap to get to what they want to know.
Oh, yeah.
So it's kind of like Apple give you a storefront, but the storefront they give you is kind of shitty.
Yeah.
Whereas if you got your own website, you can do whatever you want. You can have About Us as a separate link. You can have all these other different, you know, why you should buy from us, what makes us awesome, blah, 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 blah. And you can just have the page that has the app on it as just being about the app. Whereas on an App Store shopfront, you can't do that.
Yeah, it's not a very flexible space for developers to work with. You're stuck in that everyone gets the same thing. So is there a limit on how many screenshots you can have?
I thought there was a limit, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah. There might be a limit on the screenshots. So you have the screenshots and you have to pack a lot of information into that. I mean, how many annotated screenshots do you see on the App Store saying, you know, look at this cool feature, look at this cool feature, because the text underneath is so densely packed with information that nobody's going to read it.
That's it.
It's just...
People just look at the screenshots.
Yeah.
That's what they do. Oh, it looks pretty. Click buy. Because what else have they got to go on? There's no trials. Anyway. I didn't want to start that one again. But yeah, it's just... Yeah, absolutely right. It's terrible. And the shop front that they give them is simply insufficient for the sorts of information that you know, most developers want to convey.
Yeah.
But in any case... yeah, not sure what else there is to say about that. It sucks. Have we talked about the fact that there's no videos?
I did briefly bring that up. But yeah, you know, in addition to a screenshot, wouldn't it be nice to have a video so that the developer can have, you know, let's say you give them 2 minutes at most to sort of show the user, well, the potential customer, how the app works. You know, here are some cool things that you can do with it. Wouldn't that be fantastic?
Hey, make it like Vine. They get 5 seconds. Hi, welcome to this app. If you press the plus button, you can do this. Bye-bye, thank you. Yes, it could work.
Yes.
It's a step forward.
This is a solid idea. I like it.
They need to run with this. But they've got 5 seconds. Anyhow, so I do think it's a bit ridiculous that when you consider that they're hosting... it doesn't have to be high format video. I mean, the standard resolution on an iPhone, you know, if you halve that resolution, it'd still be clear enough.
Let's say that they're limited to 720p. That's enough.
Yeah, more than enough. And you know, if you were to do a demo on 720p for 2 minutes, the size of the file you're storing is not going to be significantly more than most of the apps on the App Store.
No.
So it can't be an argument of space. But... I don't know. I do find it rather odd in this age where you've got, you know, where we've got lots of screencasts promoting and training people on how to use software. It just seems strange that they wouldn't offer that as an option. I mean, why not?
Yeah, yeah. Because you go to any you know, developer site for their software, usually they will have a video on there. You know, it's just something that a lot of people do because it really does help to sell their software. You know, because
that's it.
Yeah, a screenshot just isn't going to do it. So you want to show people how it works. And it sort of gives the developer a chance to sort of make a more personal connection with the customer, because if they hear the developer's voice, you know, look, this is this app that I made, here are the cool things that you can do with it. You know, I kind of imagine that would help improve the quality of the reviews that are left, because now you sort of know the person that's behind it, and you know that they're a real person. So you're not going to jump on there when it doesn't do what you want and be like, oh, this app is shit, and give it one star.
Yeah, yeah, but what if you've got a weird accent? Just to play devil's advocate.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, what if you speak really weird, like us, like you and me, you know? We speak totally with a bizarre accent, don't we?
Oh, yeah, completely.
Yeah, we got slipped back, mate, and got to throw a bit more strain in there, eh? I reckon... Well, get in the pub for about half an hour, eh, after the show? Yeah?
Yeah, reckon.
What do you reckon, mate? Yeah?
Reckon.
Totally? No? See, I can't really do that convincingly. I try, but I fail dismally.
Sometimes I can.
So, yeah, maybe it's I need to have a few drinks before I can actually do that. Which is, yeah, circular. Anyway. Right. I'm having trouble focusing. I guess what... No, and I haven't been drinking. Yeah, at least not alcohol. Anyhow, so... Look, I think it's definitely would be better than what they've got now, you know, and I do think that it's not much more to ask. All the technology is already there. It's just a matter of letting them do it.
Yeah.
And it would be the sort of thing that it's an option. You don't have to do it. You know, no. You don't have to have screenshots.
You
do. But yeah, you could have it as an option, you know, and I find it, again, bizarre that they don't have that. But in any case... So, what was this about push notifications? You were talking to me about push notifications before as well.
Oh, yes. To be able to use push notifications on the Mac, you must go through the Mac App Store. So, if you're selling it direct, can't do it. I don't know how Apple polices this, but, you know, according to their terms and conditions, you can't use push notifications outside of the Mac App Store.
Oh, that's just the way they do the signing certificates and everything.
Ah.
Yeah. So, yeah, in order to register for push, you need to have a certificate from Apple that has to be signed and linked to the application in question. Because if you didn't do that, any old Joe...
shit would happen.
Yeah, well, any old Joe could create a spamming system that would basically send push notifications to every computer everywhere. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, without having to have the software installed or something like that. But yeah, it's a trust thing. And I know that sounded flaky, but it actually is. It's like it's a trusty thing.
Yeah.
What do they call it? It's like a trusted... Oh, God damn it. I used to know. I looked into this a couple of weeks ago, actually, for Safari push notifications. But anyway. So, yeah. But that does... And I guess, okay, that's a problem with the Mac App Store, because you've got a choice. You don't have to buy software and install it through the Mac App Store if you don't want to.
Yeah.
It's not a lockdown platform like iOS. So therefore, you know, it's back to this thing I keep ranting on about. The problem is choice. It's like, as soon as you've got a choice, you've got a problem. So, you know, Apple took the I'm not going to give you a choice approach with iOS App Store. And with the Mac, they've gone the other approach, which is, well, we kind of start out without an App Store, so we kind of... given you one, but it's optional, I guess. Grumble, grumble. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I'm so pleased that I went down that route instead of, you know, be like, fucking App Store only.
Yeah, well, that's true. And, I mean, I've been sort of predicting for a while that it's only a matter of time before they do lock it down. And I still believe that it is only a matter of time.
Yeah, I can definitely see them doing that.
Yeah, but how far, I don't know. How far down the road.
Yeah.
But there will be people that just, yeah... can lose it they do that.
Yeah, I'll lose it.
They'll go mental.
So I think for that to happen, either it's just going to be time, like they, you know, 5 years time, they just like, yeah, Mac App Store is the only place to get software. And everyone, you know, by then everyone just sort of accepts it. You know, for it to happen sooner, I think that maybe there'd have to be some sort of catalyst. Let's say, like, God forbid, some massive malware attack, and they're just like, nah, fuck it, locking this shit down.
Yeah, because there hasn't been enough of that yet, right? I mean, the thing is that I think you're right, though, honestly, but it's got to have to be a pretty massive malware attack where people lose a lot of something.
Yeah.
Money, probably. Because, yeah, something's going to have to give. But anyway, yeah, So, that's push notifications. Now, what about... we've sort of talked a little bit about the layout, haven't we? About all the scrolling and the...
Yeah. If you look at both of the app stores... Actually, because you can visit the iOS app store on an iPhone, on an iPad, and in iTunes. And with the Mac app store, you go to the Mac app store. All of them use horizontal scrolling, which I find to be a massive pain in the ass.
Oh, God, yeah. Or pain in the fingers.
Yeah.
But yes.
Yeah, it's... I use a... it's funny for me to say this, but... Mainly, I use a trackball. And that can only scroll up and down. I can't do left and right scrolling. So, you know, to browse the App Store, it is a real pain, you know... To be able to do it effectively, I need to switch to the Magic Trackpad or my Logitech mouse. The reason why I said that it's funny for me to be saying this because I have a lot of mice on my desk. You've seen the photos.
Oh, I have. but you know, one thing you said there right, resonates totally with me because I'll be using a standard wired mouse, left and right mouse buttons, and center wheel that only does scrolling up and down. And whenever the iTunes store comes up on iTunes on the Mac, I reach over to the damn trackpad to scroll left and right.
Yeah,
because it's easier than trying to click on the scroll, click target and try and drag it across.
Yeah,
because that's the only. But the other
thing you can do is hold shift and then scroll with the mouse wheel, because that'll change it to left and right. But you know, then that requires you using an extra hand.
See, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
how sad is that? Is that sad? I think that could be sad.
I don't know.
I'm gonna say that's sad.
Okay.
Of me. That I didn't know that. Shift, huh? All right, I'll do that next time.
Yeah. You hold down shift and scroll. So the problem that I can find with scrolling with a Magic Trackpad is sometimes it doesn't always... That works. Yeah.
Sorry.
If you're scrolling up and down and then you change to scrolling left and right, sometimes it always doesn't always detect that. And the same with on the iPad. You're trying to scroll left and right, but it's still scrolling up and down because it's either sensing it wrong or maybe there has to be a certain amount of time has to have passed before it decides that, okay, well, it's not doing... You're not trying to do this action anymore. You're trying to do a different action. It just doesn't always switch from one to the other as smoothly as you like it to.
Well, I guess the problem I got fundamentally with horizontal scrolling is it's unnatural. And the reason I say it's unnatural is because look at the screen as it is. All the screens that we work on desktops and laptops, are all landscape orientation. So you've already got maximal space in the in the X dimension. So, you know, in the case of a printed medium, you also have the same problem. You want to keep your sheets to A4 or A5 or whatever, you've got paperback size or whatever. You don't go wider in your book. You go to the next page. And we read text left to right, top to bottom, at least in Western countries anyway. And what that means is, well, why not wrap my text around to the next line and scroll up and down? Whereas if I wanted to, I guess the other option would have been, rather than scrolling up and down, you could then, when you get to the bottom of the page, you could select to go across to the right, like in iBooks, and it'll flip over to the next page. But you don't have horizontal scrolling. You know what I mean? It's like you just keep reading top to bottom and you just keep scrolling down to the bottom.
Yeah.
Why would you horizontal scroll?
Yeah.
So I think, you know what I mean? It's like horizontal scrolling where you have a choice of simply reorganizing the page makes a lot more sense.
Mm.
the reason you would do horizontal scrolling is because you don't want certain areas to be larger than a certain height. So new and noteworthy has got to be a certain height. You don't want to have, you know, iTunes recommended on the next scrolled page down, let's say. So you squish all the other ones up and horizontal scroll them, which is, I don't know, to me it just looks terrible.
Yeah.
I hate using it.
The thing to me with horizontal scrolling is it's hiding information. But I don't know, if you decided instead of having, we're going to display this many apps, you know, let's say it's 20 and you can only see 5 of them at a time with the horizontal scrolling. Let's say that you changed it so, no, okay, now there's 5 at a time, but it goes four rows down. Now, multiply that by all the different sections and categories that they have. The stuff that gets down the bottom is just going to get lost because there's always this thing of different screen sizes and, you know, how willing are people to scroll all the way to the bottom. So the stuff at the top is highly visible. The stuff at the bottom, not so much. So maybe that's why they do it, but it's still a really odd design decision to go to horizontal scrolling, because I just think the there's more information hidden than visible.
Yeah. Well, I completely agree with that. I just want to cover the tab browsing though, because yeah, that's something else that, God, that shits me. Everything, even the Finder,
yeah,
they've got tab browsing in it now. But in iTunes, no, get fucked. You don't need that. No.
And they used to have that little thing where you click on the little eye in the corner and it would bring up the thing, so that if you're already looking at something and you scroll down and say, oh, look, here's something related, you could have a quick look at that before actually going there. They've gotten rid of that. And only now that it's gone do I realize how useful that actually was.
Funny how that works.
Yeah. It's still... It's still no substitute for tab browsing. Or even just having multiple windows. Because it would...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, why not that too? Yeah, exactly right. And yeah, because what I find shitty is that it's a linear progression. You've got to... let's say I want to look at podcasts, and then I want to have a look under technology, and then I want to look under technology gadgets. There's 3 separate clicks I've got to do to get to that. Why can't I open it as a new tab and stay on technology in one, and then I can drill down as I want to go successively? But no, you can't do that. If you want to go backwards, you've either got to reset back to the beginning, or you've got to use the back arrow in the top left corner to step backwards through where you've browsed. And then when you do step backwards through your browse, I've found it doesn't always get it right.
Yeah.
No, it's immensely frustrating because the rest of the damn operating system, so all the big apps like Safari and the Finder, they all support this. It's not hard. You know, why not do it? I'm flabbergasted by that one, Clinton. I just don't get it. Why not?
It would just make comparison shopping so much easier. And as you're browsing the App Store, I mean, there's always something that you're going there to look specifically for something. And there might be something else that you say, that's cool, I might want to check that out. Well, now you're at this problem of, I can't do 2 things at once. I have to do one of these things before I can do the other thing. Which am I going to do first? Am I going to remember to do the other thing that I wanted to do? Possibly not. Can you be bothered?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, the funny thing, the way you say that, some people might hear that as being like, that's an extreme case, but I totally agree with what you're saying. And I've been there, and it's the little things like that that shit me off, because I know I have a reasonably good idea what iTunes essentially is browsing. And it really isn't that different from Safari. It really isn't that different at all. No. It's not rocket science. It just seems to me like it's a feature that the iTunes team decided that they wanted to do it this way. So,
I don't know. Maybe the App Store guys, they've been cryogenic storage since 1996. And they're like, oh, yes, this is how a browser works.
Well, you may be onto something there, mate. I don't know. So, we've talked about the layout of the store and trials and demos. I'm still hoping for those someday.
Yeah.
all in all, though, just to sum up, if we're at that point, I think the App Store on balance has been a massive step forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just there's things that, could be made better, and you could say that about anything, but there's little things like the tab browsing and little things like the, you know, having a more flexible, better shop front that includes different areas of text for different metadata and having video previews or screencasts or something. All of those things are all, you know, those are fine tweak improvements. You know, let's not a great deal of effort. Let's just put them in there and it'll make it a more feature complete product. But then there's the gaping holes like no trials and demos. And no matter how much I think about it, I just cannot come up with any kind of argument that makes any sense to me as to why you would not want it. And I've heard all sorts of people spout all sorts of theories about this, people that are well-known, popular, that have thought about this probably longer than I have, and not a single one of them convinces me as to why the hell it's a good reason not to have it. So, you know, either I'm hard to please, and that's, you know, probably possible, but never mind that. The thing is that it's one of those things they've created such a wonderful thing. With a few more steps, it could be the best thing out there. And I think it's a shame that they seem to be focusing their attention somewhere else for the moment. I can only hope that they shift their attention back to this soon, and hopefully they can push it over the line and make it the best product it can be. Because right now, the App Store is, as wonderful as it is, still needs work.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. There's still a lot that can be done to really absolutely just make it shine. And as if you improve the App Store, the experience of using it, people are going to buy more stuff. You know, the easier it is to browse, the more things people are going to look at, the more things that they're going to buy.
You know, one of the things that we didn't really talk about was searching on the App Store. That needs to be improved as well.
Oh, yeah. Especially the iTunes Store, because, you know, iTunes always tries to guess what you're searching for, and sometimes it might put apps at the top, or it might put a movie at the top, or something like that, and, it's, you know, that's always frustrating.
I think part of the issue with the search is the fact that they just don't have search in the bag. Like, someone like Google, or even Microsoft with Bing, do a better job with search. I think Apple's just nowhere near that level, and they may not be for a very long time. So this is sort of one of the things that worries me, because sometimes when you're searching for an app, it actually is easy to Google.
Yeah.
Which is a very sad indictment on the level of search capability within the Apple ecosystem. It's something that they're going to have to address. If they aren't already, they need to be addressing it at some stage, because, you know, you can't have, what is it, up to 1 million apps yet? Got to be getting close. And
oh, let's just call it like a fucking billion apps.
Oh, I don't know, but it's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah, last figure I heard, I think it was 750,000 apps. You know, if you don't just, you know, type in clock and not come back with 1,000 results. So, you know, something needs to be done to improve the ability to search in the App Store. That's another big one, but to be honest, I'm not sure. I think that's actually a much harder problem to solve than anything else that we've said. Everything else we've said is low-hanging fruit, you know? That's a big one. That's hard.
Yeah, relatively speaking, what we've, you know, the improvements that we want should be fairly easy to do, but yeah, search is complicated.
Do you reckon that if I put my mind to it, I could do it in like a few minutes? Like, no? I guess I'm just trying to point out that I know we say it's easy.
Yeah.
But I know.
Yeah, well, I as I was saying that, I'm thinking, oh, I've got to get people saved. So, oh, well, it's not that fucking easy.
Yeah, I'm sure that it isn't. But you know what? On the whole, if they can figure out what they have in relative terms, and that's, I guess, the point is, when we say it's easy in relative terms to what else they've done, it is actually relatively easy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I don't mean to say it's a trivial amount of work. So, dear listener, when you hear me say that, that's not what I mean. So, anyway. What do you think?
So, do you want to wrap it up, or do you have time to just quickly talk about how you actually, like, how you find out about apps.
Well, yeah, kind of. I think the way I find out about apps generally is through reviews from different sites. Yeah, different news sites. I won't name them, but a bunch of news sites that I follow in the tech space. People's recommendations on Twitter. And honestly, I search with Google more than I search with the bloody, you know, App Store search. I'll type in what I want and I'll say review or comparison or something like that.
Yeah, look, I'm the same. I don't browse the App Store to buy apps. I hear about it through word of mouth or through various websites that have actually reviewed it. And, you know, if something gets recommended enough, then I search for it and I'll buy it.
And the key point there is that you do that and I do that because the App Store is terrible at determining how good an app is.
Yeah.
Because there are no trials, because the search is terrible. Because the shop fronts that they give people do not break down metadata very well. For all of those reasons that we've already said, that's why we do that. Because there is very few other options. There are very few other options. But then we're also a very small group, right? We're the ones that actually read, you know, different sites, like tech sites. Most people don't. Most people just go and look at the top 10. Top 10 games.
Yeah.
Oh, that
and
looks
all
right.
That's why the top 10 always sells.
That's it. We are not the drivers of the fortunes of the App Store. As in, we, you and I, and people like us, we aren't.
Yeah.
We like to think we are, but we're not. That's a reality check for anyone out there that thinks that they are, because they're not.
This concludes Series 1 of Anodized. Don't forget to check out anodizedpodcast.com for show notes, more information on the show, and bonus material. You can follow Anodized on Twitter and app.net at AnodizedPodcast. If you have any comments or feedback, mention us. You can also head over to anodizedpodcast.com/contact to send us something a little more in-depth. You can follow John on Twitter and app.net at John Chichi. Don't forget to check out his site, techdistortion.com, and search for Pragmatic on iTunes. You can follow me on Twitter and app.net at Clinton1550. I occasionally write stuff on unsanelygreat.com. Rate us on iTunes, leave us a review, tell the friends about your show. It's the best way to help us out. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll be back in the new year.